Getting you home. This is 105 Drive with Julian Clover.
The King's Speech is on stage at the Cambridge Arts Theatre this week, and 105's Mandy Morton went along to meet the play's co-stars.
I find myself sitting next door to a king and next door to, well, I suppose what eventually became an Australian icon, although in real life he still is an Australian icon, I suppose, one way or the other, Jason Donovan and Ray Coulthard, starring in The King's Speech at the Cambridge Arts Theatre this week. Let's start with you, Jason. It seems to me that this is a part that had your name on it and it finally came to you.
It's certainly a part that I've been looking to play. I didn't actively go and search for it, but when I read it about, 14, 15 months ago, I instantly was gravitated to it and thought there was some value I could bring to it. And, in the rehearsal process, I found that there was even more to it than I thought. I'm not someone to really judge whether it's a good performance or it's a bad performance, but it's certainly, I feel comfortable in it. That's probably the best way. And it sort of has not just been about the words, it's been about the physicality. I'm not struggling with the accent, that's for sure. And it's been really difficult working with Ray Coulthard because he's a very hard actor to work with. He really doesn't give me a lot.
I wasn't even aware that it was going to turn into a slanging match here. Yeah. Ray, what's he like to work with?
And now I should say awful, shouldn't I, just to get you back. We've had a great time on it, actually. This play is ostensibly a two-hander, I guess, for an awful lot of it. And also being on tour, too. I think if you didn't get on with your counterpart, it might be quite a torturous experience. But no, thankfully, we've got on incredibly well and worked, I think, very well together and developed the bromance is blossoming on and off stage, shall we say.
What about the history of this piece? Because it's a massive piece of history. I think an awful lot of people weren't entirely aware of the goings-on until the King's Speech actually hit the celluloid. Mm. But for you, how much did you know about this history before you actually got the role of George VI?
Not a huge amount, I have to admit. I suppose, obviously, it was, before my time, as it were. But it's a fascinating story. I mean, this man who clearly felt ill-equipped to tackle the role that came his way, thinking that he never would have to do it, obviously with his upbringing, which was pretty monstrous, frankly, and then his subsequent stutter and the insecurity that comes with that. And I think to be utterly straitjacketed by his circumstances and then having to, step into that job, which, as I say, he never felt trained to do. It was always going to be his brother who took it on. And not only to become the king of the country, but to lead them to war. And also, I mean, there's a line in the play in his final speech, which is, for the second time in the lives of most of us, we are at war. So just the horror of, they knew what was coming, but, because they'd been through it not that long ago and lost, umpteen millions of men, friends, family, fathers, brothers, and then to take that on again. And also, he says, this time war can no longer be confined to the battlefields. So not only is it going to, it's going to be worse. They can bring it to us. So, as I say, not only to lead your country, but to lead it in that situation with the limitations that he had is clearly, you can't even begin to imagine what that must have been like. And also, the great thing about this play is it's a story about friendship. A man who never, by his own admission, never had a friend, doesn't understand what that means, I guess, other than his wife. So for him to find somebody that can, one, help him to overcome this stammer, but also develop him as a human being and bring him out of his shell. And so you see this man who's sort of frozen. You see him get thawed, certainly throughout the first half of the play. And then after that, in the second half, I think, then built into a king. With the help of this speech therapist and obviously by the end of it, finding a friend.
Let's talk about Lionel Loeb, because he is a very interesting character, because in some respects he's a bit of a charlatan. He sets himself up to do the speech therapy. He actually really only ever wants to be an actor. He's Australian, therefore he has a completely different way about him and is completely and utterly unintentionally devoid of any understanding of the royal family. So not a great friend to sort of pick.
No, but I think had he not been Australian, possibly the relationship would never have worked. And, you know, you forget that possibly the back story to him is very much about, you know, treating First World War victims and, you know, learning the sort of through the hard graft of becoming a therapist by default, but really having on the work experience of what it was like to deal with people with these sort of problems. So it wouldn't have mattered whether he was the king or commoner or a middle class person. I think Lionel would have treated him the same. And in fact, when Elizabeth comes to his surgery and she pulls the veil up trying to throw the fame trick in order to get Bertie into the therapy room, he says, "No, it's my game, my turf, my rules. This is how I do. This is how I treat people. I treat people the same, you know." But I think in his mind, I think there was a lot to be gained by having a client who was a king, you know, who wouldn't not, you know, take advantage is probably not the right word. But it's interesting, we had a lady who was the granddaughter of Lionel Loeb come and see the show last week. She said that, you know, to this day that, you know, it was a sort of family convention that, you know, no one was to really talk about the relationship he had with King George, other than Mark Loeb, who was the cousin who wrote a book about it, which I think the family probably weren't too happy about.
But, fairly upfront.
Yeah, but so no, it's a really interesting character to play, and it's a great Australian story as much as it's a great English story. And let's keep our fingers crossed the Aussies get the chance to see this production as well.
Let's talk about stammering. It's something which, certainly I remember in my school days, people used to be so ridiculed for it, they used to be so bullied for it, and if you were unfortunate to have that sort of malady, then really you actually missed out on an awful lot of life.
Sure.
How difficult was it to actually sort the stammer out as an actor? Because the point is, it's not overpronounced, which is something I really admire about the production. It's not there all the time. It's a very natural stammer as opposed to somebody pretending to stammer.
Right. Well, that's good to hear. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, he's relatively specific at certain points in the play, the writer, David Sidler. He says, you know, there are times when the stutter is very pronounced and times when it's not. I state in the play that, you know, he stammers whenever he gives a speech and talks to anyone other than his wife. So there's one thing, I'd never have to stammer with the wife. Clearly there's a comfort there and an ease there that just stops it happening. With Lionel, the stage directions of the play that, you know, he starts stammering quite heavily, but then as their time goes on, the stammer starts to subside. Lionel actually says at one point in the play, you know, you hardly ever stammer with me anymore. And I say, well, that's because you're paid to listen. So it is sort of mapped out to some extent in the script itself, but there's a lot of license then to sort of to play with that. I mean, it's a very technical exercise that obviously, you know, for a man who stammers, I say an awful lot in this play. As you said, if I did stammer the same all the way through, we'd probably have a 6-hour play on our hands. So it's choosing those moments to really make the audience almost uncomfortable with the stammer. I did watch a lot of George VI on YouTube, the sort of Pathé News stuff, so I did watch how he stammered. So I started from that point of view, and then, I suppose, just dramatic license, I allowed it to sort of take me over, I suppose, and just see where that went. The only way I can describe it, really, is like having a sort of constant little war going on in your head. You know what you want to say, but I've got to manufacture that thing that my body won't let me say it. There was a guy in last night from the Stammering Association here in Cambridge, and yeah, he was very sort of complimentary about it and sort of said he's overcome a lot of his stammer now. But as he said, you can never cure it. You can only learn to manage it, which is, of course, exactly what Lionel sort of helps him to do.
You know, I think the dance between the two of us in a dialogue sense is sort of, that's probably, hopefully, where the magic of the play sort of works.
We do get a dance, though, of course.
You do get a dance, yeah, you do at the end.
You mentioned that you hope it goes to Australia. Would you want to take the show to Australia?
Absolutely, yeah, if they fly us first class. Put us in nice hotels and, you know, and take us to all the wonderful spots. I think it should, and I think it will go to Australia. I'd be very surprised if it didn't. You know, it is, as I said, it's a great Australian story as much as it is an English story. It's a wonderful title, you know, fingers crossed.
I've got to ask you both, are you a royalist, Jason?
I am, actually, yeah. I don't see another system that sort of, you know, works better. And I think, you know, to a certain degree, if you look at the Americans, they'd love to have a royal family, wouldn't they, really? Maybe the royal family just needs to modernise itself, which I think it is doing anyway. Exactly. That's what needs to happen. But I think, you know, there's got to be checks on politicians. Otherwise, they would just get out of hand, wouldn't they? So at least it has some sort of consistency in history.
As Jason just said, I think in terms of the modernisation of the royal family, I think the princes are doing a remarkable job, actually. You have sort of Harry sort of being a man of the people and his Invicta Games and all that kind of stuff, and seeing him and his sense of humour, I think, which is incredibly accessible. And then William sort of being the father and the statesman. I think it's a great combination, because Harry is one of those people you think you'd quite like as your pal, you know, and I think he promotes that. So I think, yeah, I think the way it's going at the moment, I guess I'm leaning more towards royalist than not.
Thank you both for sparing the time. We wish you well with your week in Cambridge. We wish you well with your Australian tour, if it ever comes off. And it's been a pleasure to meet you both face to face.
I wish you a Merry Christmas. Yeah, even though it's April.
Now, how typical is that for Australia?
March? Yeah. Wish you a Merry Christmas.
Now, Mad March hair by the sounds of it. Yeah. Have you seen enough of him today?
Yeah, that'll do until we hit the half, I think. I'll run from Donovan.
That's Jason Donovan and Raymond Coulthard speaking to Cambridge 105's Manly Morton. You can see the King's Speech at the Cambridge Arts Theatre until Saturday if you want to book. You need to give the box office a call, and that is on 01223 50 3333. Cambridge number 50 3333.